Hey folks, Scott Weingart here with another episode of Practical Evidence. Let's do some trauma guidelines because I love trauma. So we start off with the 9th edition of the Advanced Trauma Life Support course. Now I'm not going to go through the entire set of guidelines because that would take forever. What I'm going to talk about is the differences between this new 9th edition from the 8th edition. Because I think most of you are familiar with ATLS if you're in emergency medicine and critical care. And if you're not, then you got to actually take the course. It's worth taking the course once if you're an ED doc. After that, I'm not so sure of the value, but once is worth it because you have to be able to communicate with all the other people that take the course. After that, I think we're usually ahead of the course, which is how it's supposed to be if you're in emergency medicine or you're a trauma surgeon and you're relying on the ATLS course for your information, you are about a decade behind. This, just like ACLS, sets the standard for people that aren't specialists in the field and places where you don't have a whole team taking care of the patients. ATLS is really built for one guy or gal in a community hospital somewhere without much trauma experience, and it's going to give you a good baseline level of care that'll get you through, but you're not going to be providing cutting-edge evidence-based care. All right, with that said, let's go into the changes. Change number one, you need a team, and that team should have a team leader, and that team leader should supervise the trauma. All right, well, that's not groundbreaking, but I guess it's different, so it's here in the list for whatever that's worth. Change two, they are now, and this goes along with all the other evidence looking at this subject, saying it is okay to use cuffed endotracheal tubes in pediatric patients. In fact, that is probably the way you should go in emergency medicine, where you're not going to be sizing the tube perfectly. That cuff gives you a lot of leeway to still get a good seal. But, and I agree with this as well, ideally cuff pressure should be measured as soon as feasible, and it should be less than 30 millimeters of mercury to prevent pressure necrosis. All right, they go further on the airway side to say alternative intubation devices have been developed, which can be good in trauma patients, and use your clinical judgment. And these devices may be helpful for rescuing failed endotracheal attempts. All right, let's go down to shock resuscitation. Hypertonic saline has no benefit over standard crystalloid resuscitation. Now, why is this important? Well, the 8th edition was saying hypertonic may be better. It turns out, no, not yet. There was those two EMS studies, one on brain trauma and one on general trauma, didn't show a benefit. Doesn't mean there won't be a benefit. Does it mean that eventually someone won't do the study? It just means right now, hypertonic's not better. It's not necessarily worse. You can still use it if you think it's clever. I use it all the time in the patients with trauma and coincident potential brain injury. I think that's a great time to be whipping out your 3% hypertonic, but it's not better. Okay, further on fluid resuscitation, here's where we get to the important stuff. The concept of balanced resuscitation is further emphasized, and the term aggressive resuscitation has been eliminated. Stop aggressively resuscitating because they don't want you aggressively resuscitating with fluids. Do aggressively resuscitate with blood products. Now, here's the best part. The best part of all these changes, the use of 2 liters crystalloid resuscitation as the starting point has been modified to 1 liter. Now, most of the time for us, that 1 liter has been given in the field by EMS, so we just start right up with blood products in our sick trauma patients. But I guess if they came in fresh or walked in or were dumped by friends out of a van door at the front of your ED and you hadn't given any crystalloid, you'd get away with 1 liter. We don't even bother with that if the patient is in the obvious throes of dying from hemorrhagic shock. We just start right in with massive transfusion, but don't give 2 liters to any sick trauma patient anymore. 1 liter. That's where you should stop. And then they say early use of blood and blood products for shock is also emphasized without mandating any specific ratio. They are not ready to go the ratio road yet. And that's probably wise because we don't have the exact evidence we need to say which ratio is better. All right, there's some other stuff here. Blah, blah, blah. You don't care about this stuff. DPL is no longer a mandatory skill station. It is now an optional skill station because you can get away with using the FAST, and we know this, and it just makes me happy because ultrasound rules. All right, and that's essentially it. I mean, that's essentially the differences I could find between the 8th edition and 9th edition. So, you know, no game changer. I think everything they did change is a change for the better, so I'm kind of happy. It's not always like that, but not any groundbreaking stuff here. All right, we have one more set of guidelines to go into. It's going to be on cervical spine injuries. But before we go there, let's just talk about our Bandwidth sponsor, and that is, as always, EB Medicine. EB Medicine makes EM practice. They make emergency medicine critical care, journal I'm the associate editor for with my friend Rob Arnfeldt, and they do a lot of good stuff. They are the evidence-based journal. They are now PubMed Index for their EM practice. The EMCC is coming soon, and I love these guys. So they are the Bandwidth sponsor for this month, and hopefully continuously for the duration of this podcast. Let's get to our next guideline. All right, this is from the American Association of Neurological Surgeons. They put out the spinal cord guidelines, at least in the United States here, and they just put out a new set, and the link to that is in the show notes, as always. This is pretty good stuff here. Let's go into these changes. Let's talk about some recommendations for the cardiopulmonary management of patients with C-spine injuries. Use of cardiac, hemodynamic, and respiratory monitoring devices to detect cardiovascular dysfunction and respiratory insufficiency in patients following acute spinal cord injury is recommended. Well, that's good. Correction of hypotension in spinal cord injury, SBP less than 90 when possible and as soon as possible is recommended. Well, that sounds good. And here we're back to our MAP push. Anyone who does critical care in trauma knows about the MAP push. It's the concept that if you push the patient's blood pressure higher than normal, you could actually take areas of the spinal cord that are in that, you know, ischemic penumbra and bring them through, and they might have greater recovery. The evidence behind this is not great, but the recommendation is maintenance of mean arterial blood pressure between 85 and 90 for the first week following acute spinal cord injury is recommended. So there you go. Now it's a recommendation. I think it was an option before. Don't quote me on that. All right, now here's the most important part of the guidelines. This kicks ass. Administration of methylprednisolone for the treatment of acute spinal cord injury is not recommended. Can I say that again? Not recommended. We've been dilly-dallying with this for years. We've known for years this stuff does not necessarily do net good. It does maybe some minuscule amount of good, and it does a larger amount of bad. And when you put the two together, the net is not good. So we haven't been using it for quite some time. Now they're saying don't use it. If you're doing a study, okay, but other ways, don't use it. All right, some other little stuff here. They try to get folks to stop routine immobilization in the field for patients that don't have the right mechanisms or situations to get it. So I'll just read these because I don't really know what you could do with them because they're not necessarily going to stop your EMS from having to immobilize, but it's worth discussing. So spinal immobilization of all trauma patients with cervical spine or spinal cord injury or with a mechanism of injury having potential to cause C-spine injury is still recommended. And then here we go to the good stuff. Immobilization of trauma patients who are awake, alert, and are not intoxicated without neck pain or tenderness, who do not have abnormal motor or sensory exam, and who do not have any significant associated injury that might detract from their general evaluation is not recommended, which essentially means if they meet nexus criteria, don't put them in immobilization. And what they're really referring to here is folks in the field. It would be better if they didn't come in immobilized. That would be good. Spinal mobilization in patients with penetrating trauma is not, I repeat, not recommended due to increased mortality from the delay in resuscitation. So there you go. If you get a patient with a penetrating head or neck injury and they do not have any neurological signs that are obvious, then don't immobilize them. And if they are, you know, meeting those nexus criteria in the field, don't immobilize them. Now, this would obviously have to come from medical control or whoever's making the protocols for an EMS service to say this stuff. It's, you know, putting in these guidelines doesn't do anything, but maybe this will be the impetus to allow medical directors of EMS services to stop routine immobilization. That would be great. Okay. What else? So essentially, the last part of this is they discuss what to do in patients both obtunded and completely awake who have continuing symptoms of neck pain or tenderness in the case of the awake patient, or you know, in the obtunded one, you can't obviously ask them whether they have neck pain or tenderness. What to do with those patients after they have a pristine CT scan or a three-view perfect set of x-rays with a supplemental CT scan. So after imaging is negative, what do you do on these patients? And essentially, they just left it up to you. They say you could continue your C-spine immobilization until either they're asymptomatic or wake up. You could discontinue after FlexX, discontinue after MRI, or discontinue based on the discretion of treating physician, which means you can do anything, which means a normal CT may allow you to take an untended patient and clear them. But they're not saying that that necessarily is okay. They're saying leave it up to your discretion. I don't like that. I want them to say either you need an MRI or you could stop after CT. And if they would say either of those, then that's what we would do. This kind of guideline where they just give you a bevy of options. Yeah, they think it's nice because it just lets each clinician do what they want, but it doesn't give you any protection for that, you know, 1 in 3,000. That's a miss. And therefore, I always look at guidelines like this as not empowering me. They actually take away a potential for saving a lot of tests. We could save like 2,999 MRIs if they had written a perfect CT scan is okay to clear a patient who's obtunded. That would be just swell, but they didn't do that. So what could you do? All right, and that's essentially it. That's the take-home message for ED and critical care guys that come out of the spinal cord guidelines. There's some more stuff in there, and it's worth a read if you specialize in trauma critical care. And so the link is in the show notes. But for the regular guys, that's basically the take-homes. All right, so let's get to the part of the show you really care about. What is MCRIT drinking? I'm drinking a cider. It's springtime. Ciders are always fun. These are hard ciders, obviously, because why ever drink a soft cider while doing a podcast? And so today I have the Naked Flock Hudson Valley Hard Cider. Hudson Valley is a place in upstate New York. It's quite beautiful. And this is a good cider. It's a little sweet for my taste. They have a crisp one, which is less sweet. I have to try that next week. But this one, the draft, it's quite good, quite tasty, quite springtime fresh. So check it out if you're in any place near somewhere that would sell this, which I guess is probably only New York, though I guess these folks would love a national distribution. And that's it for this episode of Practical Evidence Trauma. Scott Weingart, talk to you soon.